Welcome to Let's Talk FCA, presented by Kroll & Mooring. We are your hosts, Jason Crawford and Mona Lombardo, bringing you the latest developments with the False Claims Act. Today, we are joined by special guest Mark Troy. Mark is a partner in Kroll's Government Contracts Group in Los Angeles and has extensive experience defending False Claims Act actions for over 30 years. As this month marks the two-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Universal Health Services versus U.S. Exrel Escobar, we thought we'd welcome Mark here today to provide his thoughts on the impact of that decision. But before we get into that, I'll turn it over to Mana to provide a brief overview of the Escobar decision.
Thanks, Jason, and welcome, Mark. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
It's great to be here. I love talking about the False Claims Act.
Excellent. Let's dive right in. So the significance of the Escobar decision was twofold. First, it was notable the court validated the implied certification theory of False Claims Act liability, ruling that a claim may be false or fraudulent even if it does not expressly contain an inaccurate representation. And secondly, the court's findings regarding the materiality element of FCA liability have been a focus of great discussion and jurisprudence over the last 2 years. Just for a little bit of background, under the FCA, to find a violation, a false claim or false statement must be material. In interpreting the materiality standard, the court in Escobar found that a provision's designation as a condition of payment is not dispositive of materiality, although it might be relevant evidence. The court reasoned that under any understanding of the concept, materiality looks to the effect on the likely or actual behavior of the recipient of the alleged misrepresentation. And the court stated that a representation is material if a reasonable person would attach importance to it in deciding the transaction, or if the defendant knew or had reason to know that the recipient of the representation would attach importance to it, even if a reasonable person would not. So ultimately, materiality may be determined objectively or subjectively. But regardless, the court emphasized that the materiality standard was demanding and that minor or insubstantial violations wouldn't give rise to FCA liability. So Mark, as someone who's been litigating FCA cases for over 30 years, what's your perspective on the significance of the Escobar decision and its impact on how these cases are handled?
Well, first of all, most Supreme Court cases these days, they don't really decide particular issues. The decisions are often tailored to just the facts of the case, and so they don't resolve issues for future litigants. Not so with the Escobar decision. Escobar actually resolved a significant, perhaps the most significant issue in false claims litigation, and it will guide defendants and plaintiffs and the government in how they conduct future false claims litigation. And it did so by settling the basic issue of whether there can be an implied false claim. And as you said, it upheld the notion that there can be an implied false claim. A couple of courts had held before that the False Claims Act, as that's the title of this law, means that there had to be a claim for payment that on its face had a false statement in it. There were a few courts that held that. And the Escobar decision has cleared that up by allowing for false claims liability to be based on implied statements so that there doesn't have to be a specific false statement in a particular request for payment. But the court did so by setting a rigorous standard for how you can have an implied false statement. And as you said, that standard basically is that the implied false statement has to be material. That is, that it has to matter. It has to matter to the government.
So Mark, in the weeks following the decision, there was a lot of commentary from both the relators bar and the defense bar on who would benefit most from the ruling, and both sides initially hailed the decision a victory. Now that 2 years have passed, who do you think has benefited most from the Escobar decision?
I think that defendants benefited more than plaintiffs. I think that it was fairly predictable that the court was going to uphold the notion that there can be an implied false claim, but that the materiality standard that was articulated by the court, I think, will clearly benefit defendants. When judges and juries consider false claims cases, as much as I enjoy these cases and find them interesting, jurors are fighting boredom in these cases. I've had a judge delay a bench trial because the judge said, well, this case is just about money. I've had jurors tell me after the trial that they were very bored to hear about issues like complex military part specifications or things like Medicare billing procedures and obscure government contracts clauses. But the focus from the Escobar decision, really, it recharges the focus on, does any of this really matter? Falsity, you know, the other elements of false claims liability, falsity and knowledge, they're not real clear-cut issues. It's not always easy to tell whether a statement is true or false. And with respect to the knowledge element, it's the statute itself has a fairly weak standard of how to prove that a defendant acted knowingly. But from the Escobar decision, the focus on does all the stuff we're hearing about in this case, does it matter? It's a sensible question to be asked, and it's one that jurors can understand. So I think that that, in the end, will benefit defendants more than plaintiffs.
So there's also a footnote in Escobar where the court wrote that the materiality analysis is not too fact-intensive to decide on a motion to dismiss or on summary judgment. How do you think Escobar affected motions practices in FCA cases?
I think that the decision really does tee up the materiality question early on in the case for a motion to dismiss, for failure to state the allegation with particularity, and potentially for summary judgment. The court itself in that footnote said, we reject the defendant's assertion that materiality is too fact-intensive for courts to consider on motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment. So the court really said that the facts underlying why this matters, why this allegation matters to the government, really have to be laid out in the complaint by the plaintiff, by either the government or the QI-TAM plaintiff.
Mark, since Escobar was decided, at least a few decisions have touched upon the government's intervention decision when performing the materiality analysis. Should the government's decision to decline or intervene be a factor in determining whether compliance with a legal requirement is material to the government's payment decision?
My personal opinion is I don't think so. Traditionally, the government's decision on whether to intervene in a case or decline the case has not been viewed by courts as a commentary on the merits of the case. And the government has been pretty rigorous in defending that position. So if a defendant goes into court and argues, hey, the fact that the government declined to intervene in this case must mean that the allegations, even if true, are not material to the government, I think that's a risky approach and would likely, in most cases, result in the government filing, even if they've declined the case, they can still file a statement of interest. I think if a defendant does that, they're going to see the government walk into court with a statement of interest saying, hey, wait a minute, our decision to decline to intervene does not mean we don't think this allegation either did or would have mattered.
So along those same lines about impact early on in the case, how do you think the Escobar decision has changed the approach to discovery?
I think that relators have to allege materiality with particular facts, as I said before. So in order to do that, how is a relator, let's say an employee who works within a company, how is a relator going to know that a particular false statement or act of wrongdoing really mattered to the government? It's possible that the relator might have some role in communicating with the government in his or her job, and so may have that fact. But I think that more often than not, the relator is going to need some sort of backup in order to make that allegation. And so I would expect relators and their counsel to do Freedom of Information Act requests before they file their complaint so that they can have a particular piece of information that came from the government that shows some action that the government took with regard to the issue. Also, this ruling puts a lot more focus on government personnel. Really, in false claims litigation, most of the focus has often been on the government personnel. Did the government feel that it was cheated by these allegations? When the government declines to intervene in a QI-TAM case, really, the government's attorneys in the Justice Department and even the program personnel, they really don't want to be bothered by this case. And the government has at its disposal a set of regulations. They're named after an old case called TUI. And these TUI regulations govern what sort of information government personnel can provide, either informally or through formal discovery. And TUI regulations create a significant barrier to both sides obtaining discovery from the government when the government people are really, you know, a third-party witness in the case. I think the courts eventually will break through that barrier and not permit the government to hide behind the TUI regulations to avoid coming forward with discovery in the case on the materiality issue, because the issue is now so important to the false claims litigation. I think that the courts will eventually start compelling the government to be more cooperative as third-party witnesses in the case.
Back in April, the Supreme Court asked for the Solicitor General's views as to whether the court should grant cert in Gilead Sciences versus U.S. Exrail Campi. In Gilead, the question before the court is whether an FCA allegation should fail when the government continued to approve and pay for products after learning of alleged regulatory infractions. Mark, if you were drafting the brief for the Solicitor General's office, would you suggest that the Supreme Court revisit Escobar?
I don't think that the government should ask the court to reconsider Escobar. I think the decision is a sensible decision for all sides in the FCA litigation. And so I don't think that they need to mess around with the standard for what constitutes a material false claims violation. What I would do if I were on the government's side handling these cases is I would explain to the court in any particular litigation what the reason was for the government's either action or inaction in the case. That is, upon learning of a fraud allegation or even believing that a fraud occurred, the government may have a very valid reason for not taking any action in response to that fraud. They may really need the product to meet some immediate military need. And so canceling the contract or not paying for the goods might not be the best solution for the government. And so if I were a government attorney in that situation, I would simply explain to the court that the government's decision to continue paying the contractor and continue receiving the product is not something that reflects on the viability of the false claims allegation. The government can offer up that sort of statement in any case, whether they've intervened or not. And Like I said, the government would explain to the court in that situation that either it didn't know of the allegations at the time, or even if it did know, that it either mattered or didn't matter to the government. So I think the key for the government in these cases is to just come clean and tell the court what the impact is of the alleged conduct and whether it mattered to the government or not.
Great. Well, that's all for this episode. We want to thank Mark for joining us today and sharing his thoughts on the ongoing impact of Escobar on False Claims Act litigation. If you have any questions, Mona can be reached at 213-443-5563, and Mark can be reached at 213-443-5576, and Jason at 202-624-2562. Thanks again, and we'll see you next month.
Let's Talk FCA is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. You can find more information at kroll.com/podcasts.